Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It was a little foggy and chilly this morning, but we'll take it. The past 3 weeks of extraordinary weather has perhaps changed our perspective of comfortable or bearable while longing for sunshine. And while some overdue dry and sunny conditions are forecasted this week, there is still significant damage, cleanup, and loss. The series of atmospheric rivers forced the evacuations of tens of thousands of residents and claimed at least 20 lives. And although our snowpack and overall precipitation totals is well above average for this time of year, there are learning lessons about getting current emergency information out to the public and the shortcomings about the technology that we rely on daily. Dr. Jeffrey Mount is a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California and experienced this firsthand, as did many of us, and joins us now. Good morning, Dr. Mount. Jeffrey.
Vicky, thanks. Nice to be here.
So you typically join us about all things water, infrastructure to storage, flood control, and of course, drought, which was actually our last conversation on Insight.
Correct.
And you emailed me at the start of the new year as we began these series of atmospheric rivers about reminding me how the disaster memory half-life is short. So I guess reminding me about all of the what we were in for, we didn't really know what we were in for. How do you reflect on the past 3 weeks?
Well, I can tell you, as somebody who loves watching weather and rivers and all the rest of the stuff that I do, that was a really fun 3 weeks for me, until it wasn't. And I can pretty much say that's the case for most people here. That was an extraordinary but not unprecedented 3 weeks in precipitation in California. What was so striking about it, Vicky, was the fact that it was everywhere. Everywhere got wet in California. That's not that common. And some of our really, really big years, it's everywhere. But I think the signature of this one was not so much, and this may be relative to our conversation today, it was not so much that it rained hard, it blew like heck. And we had significant damages, not just in the Bay Area, not just out here, but also even in Southern California. And it was associated with the punch of the weather, not just the precipitation.
You know, during the series of storms, you know, I had a Facebook memory or multiple back in 2017 and reporting a flooding. You know, in South Sacramento where I was covering, also just watching the Yolo Bypass filling up to look like a choppy lake. And that was 5 years ago. So how does that compare to what we've just went through now in 2023?
So 2017 is a lot like what we just went through. As you know, that was the year, depending on where you were, that was record precipitation, but it started about this time, but it continued on into the spring. The storm door didn't slam shut like it did last year in early January. So this was similar to 2017, but for old hands like us, I've lived in the Valley for 42 years, this was really more reminiscent of 82 and 83, which were years that had, you know, tremendous soakings that occurred, but also really big winds, surprisingly high winds, which caused widespread damage, mostly from falling trees. So 2017 didn't have that as much as we had this one. And also 2017 was a bit warmer. I think in the end, at the end of the year, we're going to look back at this particular series of storms as being just cold enough that we socked away a massive snowpack. I mean, really, it's very impressive. I mean, there are places that got 77 inches of liquid precipitation, which is a mind-boggling amount. And of course, if you've been up to the Sierras, you know, it's really an extraordinary pile of snow up there.
Yeah. And for anyone, they probably shouldn't have tried to brave, you know, passing through I-80. It was just like whiteout conditions. Yeah. Caltrans was sending videos that looked like photos because everything was
just white
and at a standstill.
Yeah.
So what was interesting this time, Jeffrey, was that you also wrote about how crisis communication suffers during natural disasters. And this was following your personal experience during everything that we just went through. At what point were you like, I need to write about my experience?
Well, I want to make perfectly clear, my wife and I did not suffer. There are people who genuinely suffered during all of this. But it was the moments of looking at each other going, we've lost all communication. We have no way to communicate. And admittedly, I'm somebody who's a nerd and wants to follow every detail. But also, should I be concerned? And how do I protect myself? And we had zero communication. Vicky, should I tell you, I'll give you this story. And again, remember, I'm making this lighthearted when in fact it was serious business for lots of people. But my wife and I had been up at our place in the Sierras weekend before last when we really got blasted here in Sacramento. And we got to see firsthand the damage as we came through Sacramento and south of Sacramento with telephone poles snapped in half. I mean, that's tornado force winds that do that kind of thing. And we said, this is extraordinary. Power had been out at our house in Davis, but it had come back on by the time we were there. So everything's good, right? Zero internet. Cell phones didn't work. We were getting nothing. And so that then the two things that happened that I noticed that we're really good friends, my wife and I, we were kind of snippy with each other because we couldn't communicate with the rest of the world, which we found very amusing afterwards. But then it began to dawn on me how much things have changed since I've been here in the Valley. So what did I used to do? I used to, when times like this, I would go to the old standby. So I'd get out the battery-operated AM radio. I went. Tried to find out what was going on, and there was nothing available. It was either talk radio, sports, or radio in which I didn't understand the language, which highlights a real challenge in disaster communication.
Language barriers.
Oh, we are such a diverse community here. How do you communicate with those people? So that was no good. Then I went to my favorite standby, television. Oh, wait a minute. I'm hooked up. I like most people in the area, have given up on my rabbit ears.
Yeah.
And now do it on – I use the internet. So that was zero, and I couldn't get anything there. And by the way, I tried to tune into you, and you guys were off the air.
Yeah, for a period, we were.
Yeah,
I mean,
so there
because
was
very significant.
Nothing. Wait, there's always the landline, right? And so I went to the landline, and my wife and I laughed about this because just 2 months ago we disconnected it, like so many people, because landlines are self-powered. So they work, but not if you've disconnected it. And right now the FCC is trying to push really hard for everybody to disconnect their landlines and just go with basically fiber optic cable, which is your internet. And I thought, what's happening throughout Sacramento to people who – this is crazy. So then finally I got in the car and drove across town where I got a cell signal. And sure enough, what do I check? Facebook? Twitter? Well, only 1 in 5 Americans are on Twitter. So that's no good, except I noticed some counties using Twitter to send out their emergency. So it really was pretty bad. The good news is, let me make this, there's a bright side to this. Every county in California now has an emergency system, and they're relying on basically texts. So if the problem is, you have to opt in. You know, it's not.
You do have to sign up
for it. So there's a really good one for Sacramento, Yolo, and Placer County, but you got to sign up for it. But all you get there is an emergency. You don't get information. And my belief strongly in crisis communication is it's more than just a get out of the way alert, runaway alert. You really need a broad amount of information. I used to sit on the flood board here in Central Valley before I was fired by Arnold Schwarzenegger, terminated by the Terminator, as I tell people. it was for saying we probably shouldn't be putting houses behind these levees. That's why I was fired. But there, we spent most of our time worrying about response, preparation, and response in emergency saves lives. So it dawned on me we're on a funny trend here that might be worth thinking about again. And as I say, our cell was knocked out, completely knocked out. So we didn't get cell for 3 days.
Yeah, and learning it the hard way. I mean, I was even thinking as a journalist, I mean, I was able to stay updated, but I knew where to go on social media. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I am on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook. Who to follow in addition to getting press releases from agencies. But there wasn't really a one-stop shop.
Nope.
To get this info to residents, especially if you have like Apple TV or Roku, and that's completely down, so you can't even watch local TV stations.
Correct. And I want to add to this. It turns out there is no standard system of emergency broadcasts. Each county is doing their own thing. And some of them, if I went and did an informal survey of them, some are just perfectly awful to try and sign up for. And of course, you have to give an address. You can't just say, I'd like to be on this emergency broadcast system. So this highlighted something I know in talking with colleagues that people in the emergency response world worry a lot about, that we are undergoing these big changes as people are turning off their landlines, turning off their TV. They're talking about no longer having AM radio in new cars, for example. I mean, so as that begins to slide away, what are we doing in terms of broadcasting information? And let me say, what's most important, it's not just a runaway announcement. It's information about what's taking place and what's unfolding. Highway 99 is closed now, right, because of flooding. And, you know, how do you find that out? Well, there was a billboard as I drove in this morning that said 99 was closed. Unfortunately, you guys here at CAP Radio are telling people. But if communications are down all over the place, how do you get information? And I think that's a key. I have friends who didn't have power for more than 6 days. And what do you do during that?
Especially if the only kind of reliable, you know, and I say that kind of loosely, way of communicating is cell service, because cell service and data get strained when everyone is using their mobile phones.
Oh, I agree. And my neighborhood is a classic, which is, you know, upper middle class neighborhood in Davis. And so many of them, I actually met neighbors I've never met before. And the first question was always, do you have internet? can I have it? But the second was they had their cell phone in their hand and they were trying to use their cell phone to basically communicate. And it was a tragedy of the commons. So even when the cell tower was working again, the locals crushed it by demand. So there was nothing you could do. You could make a phone call, but that was it.
Given that you look at these issues through the lens of solutions from a policy perspective, what can be done to improve these disconnects that you're talking about ahead of the next natural disaster? It may not be a series of storms. It can be a plethora of things.
Well, I'm actually far more worried about an earthquake. And we know exactly what happened in Paradise at the fire in Paradise. And was that 27 people died? A lot of that
for more than 80.
I'm sorry. I'm mixing them up. But that was a failure to communicate. And so I think this is probably worth something for the legislature to sit down and think about. And they did after those. But, you know, there were hearings. I don't remember that there was great advances in policy. But we need a better communication system since we're switching almost entirely to cell phones for communication. So what do we do? How do we do it? I mean, I have an array of ideas. You don't have that much time. I think this is worth a second look. And it probably is a good idea for the legislature to sit and take a second look at it and gets at least some uniformity in that communication throughout the state so that if I'm in San Joaquin County, I am getting notified and of what's going on, not just run away. But what's going on?
Yeah, because we're all connected. It's not these
right.
Borders are pretty much invisible when you're
right.
Going from Sacramento to Yolo to San Joaquin and in Placer counties.
Yeah, we have this other problem, which we have to worry about, is a lack of trust in government, but government ultimately has to be the source of this emergency management. And I think we'll look back at some of the deaths that took place during this as people who just simply ignored warnings. For whatever reason, they ignored warnings and they died in the process. So, again, that communication is critical. I did dig out some of the literature on this. That communication, the breakdown in communication in Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, was a solid source of the hundreds of deaths there. People just didn't know what to do.
And the flood risk in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Valleys is comparable to the flood risk in Katrina. What took place?
It was. Sacramento was the next Katrina. And I do have to say, I have to compliment the people at the Sacramento Area Flood Control Agency, along with their partners at the Army Corps of Engineers, Bureau of Reclamation, Doris Matsui. There's just all these people came together after Hurricane Katrina. I mean, that was a real wake up and have put immense efforts into trying to reduce flood risk here. Flood risk is still high because you keep building homes behind those levees, the very thing I got terminated by the Terminator for complaining about. but it is so much better than it was 20 years ago.
How are our levees holding up? We have thousands of miles of levees.
Oh, we do indeed. I mean, just there's more than 1,700 miles in just the Sacramento-San Joaquin flood control system. There's 1,100 miles in the Delta alone. And then there are thousands of miles that we don't even know about in the valley. And I will tell you that in general, things held up well. The Casumnes was not a surprise to anyone because those are not levees that are intended to protect people's homes. Those are what you'd think of as rural agricultural levees, and they failed, and it was expected. I mean, it really kind of I don't say it was no surprise. There was more water in the Casumnes than was predicted, but those when you in Michigan Bar, when you get to those levels, you know you're going to have levee failures downstream. But the rest of the system held together very well. I do want to point out, though, you had two giant empty holes in the ground, which we can call Shasta Reservoir and Oroville, that are still filling, and they're releasing nothing out of them. And that made a huge difference on the Sacramento side, the amount of water coming down. But as I drove in today to see you, it was glorious to see the Yolo Bypass water from levee to levee, moving down at not a lot of water, but a modest amount of water moving down the Yolo Bypass. That's what it's designed for. So the system did well. Again, it really helped having two empty reservoirs.
If it becomes the norm that we have these series of back-to-back atmospheric rivers, how will this impact water storage and flood control in California? As you mentioned, I mean, there was no one in California that was left unscathed from this wet weather the first 2 weeks and plus of 2023.
Well, I'll also point out that there will hardly be anybody in California who won't benefit from this. I mean, so even though this was an awful lot of water to choke down, it really helps in terms of water supply. But this highlights something that we don't like to talk much about. That is our big reservoirs. We got an illustration of this with Folsom. Folsom has to set aside a very large reserve to protect Sacramento downstream for flooding, so they have to let water out. And so they've been madly letting water out of Folsom, less so now, to try and keep space for managing floods. Had Shasta and Oroville, had we had a normal year or a wet year last year, they would have been pretty full coming into this season, and they would be full now, and they would be having to let their water go. And this is this constant tension between reservoir storage and flood control. Here's the good news, as far as I'm concerned. I was emailing with colleagues last night. Helen Dahlke at UC Davis is probably the smartest mind on groundwater recharge in the valley. And the numbers are huge about the amount of water that went into groundwater. So through no effort on our part other than empty fields, a whole lot of water went into groundwater. And I remind you, a third of our supply on average comes from groundwater, and two-thirds during a drought comes from groundwater. So this was for water, this was great. It was also really good for the environment, by the way. I mean, it just did wonderful things for fish and birds. That's the silver lining. Now, if you got damaged by it, you got hurt, I mean, again, the punch of these storms was really amazing to watch. I mean, literally, a telephone pole snapped in half. That's a vision we normally have when we look at tornadoes. Mm-hmm. So that's what it is. But the bottom line for you, Vicky, is for all of us, is that these atmospheric rivers are getting bigger. I'm not sure how much bigger they were this time around, creating a greater and greater challenge to try and store them when we're also trying to keep them out of our houses. That's the big challenge.
And that keeps your job very interesting, Jeffrey.
One would refer to what I do as a target-rich environment. there's always something to talk about.
Which is why you're a regular here. Jeffrey, thanks so much for
Vicky,
stopping by.
Lovely to be here.
Dr. Jeffrey Mount is a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Over 30 restaurants are joining together to entice you back to Sacramento with a deal that is pretty hard to beat. Plus, for just $1 more, you can support a great cause while enjoying some of the best food in Sacramento. And in a few minutes, we'll also learn about a new concept in downtown, a pop-up bar that's catering to people who don't want the alcohol. Yes, a sober, curious bar in the capital city. But first, we welcome Madeline Smith with Downtown Sacramento Partnership, here to tell us about Dine Downtown. Good morning, Madeline.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So for people who haven't partaken, I guess, in Dine Downtown. Explain to listeners what exactly it is.
Yeah, of course. We've hosted Dine Downtown for the last 18 years. It's always in January because it is a notoriously slow time of year for restaurants. But also after the holiday, you get into kind of a little lull. So it's nice for us to be able to provide this experience. It's three courses at every restaurant, $45 at every restaurant. We have 34 participating restaurants, and it's now until Sunday.
And it also includes a good cause. It's benefiting the food literacy in Sacramento. What exactly is that?
Yeah, the Food Literacy Center focuses on educating kids on the importance of food decisions and the impact it can have on your lives. But they're an amazing cause, and we're so excited to partner with them this year.
Great. Dine Downtown started, what, about nearly 20 years ago, right? In 2005. How has it evolved over the years as restaurants have grown and evolved in downtown Sacramento?
Yeah. It's been a pretty wild ride. I think it's something that everybody looks forward to every year, which is always really nice. So it's one of those things where even before we announce it, we have people calling to see when's it going to start, who's participating. So that's really nice. I think as the farm to fork capital, people love going out to eat and love supporting these restaurants. But especially now in times where community is really necessary, it's even more important to bring everybody together for this experience.
Did it take place during the pandemic when there was a shutdown in a takeout way? Or
we did not do it in 2021. 2020, of course, happened after, so
right.
The pandemic started after. And then in 2022, we altered the program a little bit for the ease of restaurants, especially takeout lunch, different tiered structure so more restaurants could participate, and also so that consumers could feel safer. That was really important to us.
What I love about Dine Downtown is it's just a great excuse to get out and, and get out of your, you know, comfort zone, try new restaurants maybe you've been thinking about. I know we have a good amount to choose from, almost three dozen. Where do you suggest people start? That can be a little overwhelming for someone.
Of course. I think absolutely making sure that you first go to the restaurants where you haven't gone yet. Maybe the price tag kind of scared you a little bit, or you've been waiting to try it. The nice thing about Dine Downtown is all of these restaurants have created their own specific Dine Downtown menus. So even if you love a restaurant and go there frequently, you'll be able to try something new. So that's really nice. I just went to Frank Fats on Saturday. They are a personal favorite, and I look forward to Dine Downtown every year. And I think just going to kind of like the luxury restaurants is a really nice time around now. So Camden, Grange, those are just a few.
At a nice price point, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Great for date night.
You also have a special promotion, right? Like the first 2,000 participants get some swag. Have you hit that yet, or is that still an option for people?
As far as I know, we have already hit that. I think we hit it right after the first night. We created this like special swag where if you hold it up, it's in the shape of a Polaroid. So you could hold it up to your food and take a photo. And it's a little keychain you carry with you. So it's really fun.
Oh, that's pretty awesome. You know, we just finished talking about 3 weeks of extreme weather. I mean, what are you hearing about businesses, about the impact either financially, damage, or any issues related to these storms that we went through?
Yeah, it is an unfortunate time of year, just I think anyways for restaurants and the hospitality industry, but especially with the storm impact, it's been really rough. Last weekend, after speaking to the restaurants, we found that there were more visitors than before because I think people are just tired of being inside and they need a chance to go out. But before, that has been really tough.
Let's end on a good note because the vibe in downtown Indoco is all things Kings, right? They are red hot right now. Games are selling out. Playoffs hopefully are in sight, not wanting to jinx it. But I mean, I imagine with the downtown partnership, you must all be starting to talk about what an NBA playoff might look like in downtown if the Kings get there. And it's all good things for the surrounding restaurants and businesses.
Oh, yeah. Hospitality has a huge impact on downtown and just on the central social city in general. If we were to have something like that happen, it would provide a tremendous opportunity for the entire region with a focus on downtown.
Madeline, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Madeline Smith is with the Downtown Sacramento Partnership, and we do have a link on Dine Downtown on our Insight page at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. ¶¶ Well, as the new year begins, some people begin the annual sober tradition of Dry January and say goodbye to alcohol for the month, and others take sober curiosity even further. In the past couple years, mocktails have been taking up the real estate on cocktail menus, and in Sacramento, a new pop-up bar is creating a social atmosphere without the booze. Amanda Brincat and Catherine Altman are the minds behind the Tito List, a non-alcoholic social bar in downtown. Welcome to Insight, Amanda and Catherine.
Hi.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
Where did this concept come about?
Catherine and I have always had really active social lives. And so in 2022, we decided that alcohol wasn't serving us anymore and we wanted to kind of cut it out. So once we did, we realized very quickly that there weren't a lot of social activities that were not centered on alcohol. So we had a lot of conversations with friends and family about this and realized that this was a common problem for people. They wanted to go out, but, you know, maybe felt hesitant about going into an environment with alcohol in it if they were trying to cut back or cut it out completely. So we thought that we would be the ones to open something like that.
How do you describe the atmosphere of the Tito List?
So we want it to feel like a bar. We have a lot of events planned, like live music and sippin' shops. We had one last weekend. It was a lot of fun. There's always music, good vibes.
You both of you were also part of the Calling All Dreamers in Sacramento, right? And this plays a role in that as well.
Yeah, we still are. We're a finalist in the program, and I think it ends in April, but...
Yeah, it's opened up some really good opportunities for us. Working with the different partners that the Downtown SAC Partnership has allowed us to get into the space that we are in. So really great building ownership, great brokers, just really great support in the community, business community and social scene. So it's opened up a lot of doors for us. And
so that's why the Kickstarter came in, right? So then you can actually create this pop-up bar for the new year.
Yes. Exactly. So we launched the Kickstarter campaign in December. It ran for a month and we were successful in funding it. So over the next couple of weeks, the space will be embellished quite a bit. It'll feel more like a lounge, a bar, just a really fun social space to come, you know, hang out and have a fun drink.
Were there other like sober, non-alcoholic bars or pop-up bars across the country and other cities that you wanted to emulate or gained inspiration from?
Yeah, so we work with Chris Marshall. He's the owner of Sands Bar in Austin, and he was kind of the first, you know, the pioneer to start this sober bar movement. But there are a few others around the country.
There's an Ocean Beach Cafe in San Francisco, which is probably the closest. There's a couple of new ones in Southern California. Florida has several, so they are starting to pop up all over.
Where did the name come from?
We just were kind of throwing things around one day, you know, ideating on a bunch of different names, and a teetotaler, somebody who doesn't drink. And so we were like, well, the teetotalist is a fun name for a bar. You know, like the place itself is alcohol free, but that doesn't mean everybody that comes in is sober or alcohol free themselves.
So it's one thing having a concept, but now y'all are actually open. You have people in enjoying the Tito List. How has it been?
Oh, it's been great. It's been busy. I think even busier than we thought it would be. But it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, lots of good support. We have a few regulars already, you know, friendly faces, people coming in more than once. We've only been open for 2 weekends so far. So, yeah, it feels pretty great.
What are they telling you? I imagine it since you've had such a strong reception in just the first 2 weeks, maybe this was long overdue.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of the feedback that we get is people have been waiting for something like this. So whether they've been sober on and off or they're just taking a break, they're like, when I am not drinking alcohol, I feel like there's nothing fun to go do. So, you know, we have gotten a lot of feedback like that, as well as, you know, this is also a safe space for people who may be in recovery and have that trigger of being around alcohol. So having somewhere to go that doesn't have that pressure is, you know, I think a really good thing for people.
Let's get to some of the drinks that you all created. There's a Lively Sour, December Daydream. What are some favorites?
Yeah, I think the December Daydream is probably the most popular out of those two. It's made with a spirit that is not meant to replicate something that's an alcohol-based spirit. So it's a little spicy, a little fruity. So we use that in two different variations. And then I think probably our most popular cocktail is the Clover Club. We watched Drink Masters on Netflix and
perfect
Catherine was
for,
like...
It sounds perfect for the weather.
Yes, it's delicious. It's got some raspberry simple syrup, but we saw it on Netflix and Catherine was like, we have to learn how to make a non-alcoholic version. So we did. And It's been great.
Yeah,
I know that the location is temporary. It's a pop-up. But what are the hopes of it becoming permanent?
I mean, we're testing out the space right now, and we're working with the landlords. We are also interested in another space in the building. But we like the location so far. A lot of people like it.
Yeah, and for those who are unfamiliar, I mean, it's off on a great spot on K Street, you know? So you have Doko, and then you have all of these restaurants and businesses that are lining, and you're just a part of that. So it's incredibly walkable for people just to pop in.
Yes.
Exactly. And you get that energy of downtown in the arena, especially on game nights. You get people walking by celebrating lately. So it's a pretty great spot.
How long will y'all be open, the pop-up?
We'll be open through the end of March.
Plenty of time for people to check it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that you want to pair some other events. I know that there was a sippin' shop, but what other events do you have planned?
So we have live music this Friday. We have an open mic night on February 2nd. We're doing queer speed dating on February 9th. We're doing another sip and shop
that
next
sounds
month.
Sounds like fun.
Yes. lots of fun. A big variety of events. Everything from like tarot stand-up to someone's interested in hosting karaoke. So we just want to make it fun and, you know, all the fun things that you would get at any other bar.
Finally, do you think this is part of a larger trend that the popularity of zero-proof drinking will just continue to grow, and we're going to see similar sober spaces in across the Sacramento Valley, even beyond downtown Sacramento?
Yeah, I think we're amazed by how many people we meet that don't drink, but also the younger generations, they don't drink as much either. So I definitely think it's a growing trend.
Lots of studies out there showing that, alcohol consumption is declining rapidly. We're just the first here, but I think there'll be several more in the future, and I hope that there is.
Well, in at the right time. Amanda and Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Amanda Brincat and Catherine Altman are the minds behind The Tito List, a non-alcoholic social bar in downtown Sacramento. Still ahead, the origins and health benefits of tea date back millennia. We'll meet the researchers devoted to learning about the history and science of tea. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. It is one of the most, or if not the most popular beverage in the world, tea. And although it is just simply three letters, the beverage history is vast and varieties are wide-ranging. The origins of tea trace back millennia and has proven to be lucrative as it's spread in popularity across the globe. And really anything with that much history has a place on a university campus. UC Davis has research and an annual gathering of academics from across the country devoted to researching tea with a historical, scientific, as well a cultural lens. Professors Catherine Burnett and Jacqueline Gervais-Haig join us to discuss the history and science of tea ahead of the Global Tea Initiative Colloquium at UC Davis taking place this Thursday, January 19th. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
You know, I want to start off with, we're going to dive into the research, but when did you both fall in love with tea? What is your tea love story? Professor Burnett, I'll start with you.
It's through the teapots. So I'm an art historian and I like things and I love ceramics. And I'm a Chinese art historian. And so China has this amazing history of teapots. And teapots are so inventive in shape. And I actually really got into it when I was researching my first book on the importance of originality in 17th century culture and realized that some of the leading theorists were tied into the teapot makers. And so I became curious about why teapots suddenly shrank down and became small. And the rest is history.
Mm. Well, Professor Gervais-Haig, how about you?
Well, first, Vicky, thank you very much for having Catherine and I here today on your show today. I fell in love with tea in Taiwan. One of my dear friends took me out to my first tea garden, and it looked just like Napa Valley to me. And I asked him, why aren't we growing tea in California? And he just laughed. And so from that moment on, I have really have a passion for tea and its chemistry.
Yeah. And you have a chemistry background. So I imagine researching tea must be pretty fun.
Oh, my goodness. It's so much fun. I really enjoy it. We get to my students and I get to regularly drink tea because we are always exploring the sensory experience that we're having with the and trying to match that to the components that are actually in the cup of tea.
Mm. And Professor Burnett, I mean, you lead the Global Tea Initiative at UC Davis. What is the origin story of GTI?
Oh, it's so much fun. So, in fact, it was an accident. All of the best things in my life seem to be. And so our wonderful librarian, Axel Borg, wanted me to get together with Daryl Cordy because he's very interested in Japanese art and ceramics. And so you have to meet him. You have to be like, yeah, he's not going to be interested in me. I do China, you know. Anyway, Axel persisted, and we had a lunch. And over lunch, I happened to have brought some teapots pursuant to another conversation, and Daryl looked down, and he picks up one of the teapots, and he goes, where did these come from? He can be rather gruff. And I said, well, I brought them because blah, blah, blah. And he said, Catherine. He picks one up, and he goes, Catherine, what I don't understand is, why doesn't UC Davis study tea? And I'm like, oh! That's a good question. Why doesn't UC Davis study tea? UC Davis should study tea. I have this article that I've been dying to write on why teapots went small in the 17th century. We have all these amazing people in East Asian studies. We have all these people do beverage studies on campus. Let's make it happen. And so out of that came GTI.
Who goes to these colloquiums?
Oh, well, that's great. Thank you for asking, everybody. So what's shocking, we thought that we'd start out with, you know, it would be a nice little academic thing and 50 people would show up. Well, the first time came, it was 400.
Wow.
And it's not just from our community on campus and in the local area, but also it was at that point regional. So people come literally from California, from the nation, from around the world to these events. They're quite large, and it draws academics, experts in the industry, aficionados, the general curious public, our students and scholars. And if I can just do a little plug, so Thursday's event is on tea and value in our UC Davis Conference Center. It's free and open to the public. Please register online on our GTI website.
It's all day.
It's all day. Registration from around 8:30 or 9, and then we plunge right in. And with academic panels, but also at the end, an industry panel. So the leaders of the industry are there, and they make sure to be there. And it's really wonderful. Our students get to talk to them, get to talk about internship and job opportunities. It's a really remarkable experience, I have to say.
Professor Gervais-Haig, I would imagine, or I guess when you started your background in chemistry, did you think it would evolve to going to colloquiums about tea?
Never. I even tell my students, I said, if I would have known then what I know now, I would have definitely, you know, pursued food science at a very early stage in my career. I just like to say, I think Daryl did plant the seed, but Catherine has really cultivated the whole tea research culture on campus. And the fact that we've had 8 of these has really cemented the research efforts and brought the world, like the global tea industry, to UC Davis and has really facilitated our research.
Well, the wonderful thing about it is just you're constantly learning about tea. What has surprised you most during these 8 years of research and annual gatherings?
I think one of the things that has surprised me the most, first of all, I really didn't appreciate how the global business model of tea. What has really come to light for me is that the sustainability and how much the tea enterprise really feeds into issues of sustainability in agriculture. and how that impacts actually the industry here in the United States. And I think it's a really important area that can engage students from all different kinds of backgrounds into something of great interest to them.
Yeah, so you started with an idea, and now it has evolved and grown by leaps and bounds. What has surprised you most during this time?
Just how wonderful it is, actually. I mean, the friendships that you develop, the interdisciplinarity and the engagement of the research and the engagements with the people. It's just this amazing thing that, yeah, I'm an art historian, which by definition is a very interdisciplinary kind of thing to do. But what I can learn from Jackie and my colleagues in science really and the industry affects how I think and how I teach and how I do my research. So it's one of the surprising and wonderful things is how interconnected the science and the culture and the industry really are. My seminar this quarter is on the spread of tea culture from China into Southeast Asia. And we're looking at global trade and issues of economics and how things get there and what, when and how you know. And all these things are just so incredibly fascinating. I wish that we could do these colloquia or these events more often in the year because they're just so fascinating.
Okay, so what makes tea tea?
What makes tea? Well, what I focus on is what we call true tea. And true tea comes from a plant called Camellia sinensis. Camellia is a type of plant, but sinensis is actually a variety from China. That's what the sinensis part is in it. And then within that class, there can be many different types of varieties. Some come from more the Assam region of India, which are called Assamica varieties. And so tea comes from the leaves of these plants. So you extract the leaves of the plants to get your cup of tea.
Can you grow this plant in California?
Yes, the plant grows very well in many parts of the United States. It was demonstrated in the 1960s that tea could be grown very well here in California by researchers at UC Davis, Carl Ingridson. But years before that, 70 years before that, the USDA had actually invested in research in the southern states, and Charles Shepard was the first to demonstrate that very high-quality teas could be grown in the southern states, for example, South Carolina. And today we have growers throughout the United States going up to Washington, Oregon, Mississippi, Louisiana, Georgia, still the southern states, and here in California as well.
What I found interesting was that, you know, how tea was discovered and obviously millennia ago, but that it didn't necessarily start as a beverage, right, Professor Burnett? It was actually edible.
Right, right. So as far as we know, in China is credited for the first place to produce tea as an edible product. And it went as far as the records show, it went from some kind of a beverage and then into a medicine and then into a soup and then into the beverage that we think of today. But, you know, there are archaeological records that show that tea was being drunk all the way up in like Shandong, like the Boston of China. And it was even in the 5th to 3rd century BCE. So whether it was produced there or not, one suspects it would have been. But people were drinking it there that early, presumably as a beverage. So as far as we know with the records, it starts as a healthful medicine. And then people like it enough to make it into a thing for soup. And then from that, they like it enough to make it into a beverage.
Do you know what people would use it in terms of its health properties early on? Because it seems like they knew it from the start that it was more than just tasty.
Right.
Yeah, I think initially there are reports of tea having a calming effect. Of course, it was used, hot water was being used back in a time where water might not have been so pure. And so that also, the fact that you were boiling the water in order to make the tea was deemed to be healthier because, of course, you'd be killing any microbes that might be in the water.
When I think of tea, obviously there's so many different varieties from oolong to green tea, but there's black tea, which has caffeine. How does tea differ from coffee?
Well, so actually all tea, whether it's black tea or green tea or oolong tea, it all comes from the same plant. So one plant can make all of those different types of tea. What determines the type of tea is the way that the tea leaf is processed. Okay. And so in tea, it's a leaf. We're actually processing the leaf. And we oxidize it to different stages to give either white tea or green tea. And black is fully oxidized tea. Coffee comes from the bean. It's a fruit. It actually comes from the fruit of the plant, which is a very different chemical composition. And then that bean then is roasted in different ways to give you your different types of coffees. Mm.
Is the caffeine different if you have caffeinated tea versus coffee? Is the feeling the same?
Well, coffee has about 100 milligrams of caffeine per cup. It depends on how the tea is brewed as to how much caffeine it actually ends up in the cup. But in tea, there is another component called theanine that actually interacts with the caffeine. They work together to give you a stimulated yet calm effect, whereas tea does not have theanine.
I know that we also know so little about...
Coffee doesn't have theanine.
Coffee. Yeah. I know that there's still so much more to learn about tea, but what do we know about the health benefits of drinking tea?
A lot. So we know studies indicate... I'm going to emphasize the indicate because we always have to hedge here with scientific information. But studies indicate that tea can be beneficial towards as an anti-carcinogenic. It can help with diabetes. It can lower maybe even cholesterol. It can affect the gut health. Our colleague Yvonne Wan in the med school in pathology has done a serious work on gut health with tea. It can lower blood pressure. It can lower glucose levels. Jackie,
and then of course the fact that you're enjoying a cup of tea, you know, that has a lot to do with your mental well-being. So you know, those studies are a little bit harder to prove, but certainly there are numerous studies indicating the attributes of the well-being, sense of well-being we get from tea.
Finally, I'm going to ask you both this. For someone who wants to dip their toe into tea but feels overwhelmed because there's just so many to choose from, what advice do you have?
I like to say, try it. Mm-hmm. Try different ones. And I would point folks towards whole leaf teas and just to try them and follow the directions on the package. One thing you want to worry about is overbrewing the tea. Usually doesn't take too long because if you overbrew it, it might end up too bitter or something because the longer you extract the tea, the more chemical components that go into the cup. But I would just... encourage folks to experiment, see what they like, because it really is a personal preference.
Yeah. And I would just add to everything that Jackie just said is also, besides the brewing, also watch for the water temperature. Because if you scald the leaves and burn them, there's no way, even if you have a great leaf in your cup, it's not going to taste good. So green teas are going to be maybe 170 plus or minus degrees for heat, and black teas go up to 190 to 205. But you really don't want to, you really need to pay attention to the water temperature. But again, try, you know, why don't you get three different kinds and taste them and see what you like. And what's like wine, sometimes you want a red wine, sometimes you want a white wine, sometimes you want a sweet one, and so on. So, you know, try it and just enjoy yourself.
And try it with friends.
Yes.
It's really fun to enjoy with others.
Yeah. It definitely is a culture and community surrounding tea, which is why there is a colloquium and event at UC Davis on Thursday. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And that is Professors Jacqueline Gervais-Haig and Catherine Burnett. We do have more information on the Global Tea Initiative colloquium at UC Davis on Thursday. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.